Okay. All right. Hey, everybody. We are live at MythCon here tonight. We are at the annual conference, I should say, of the Mythopoeic Society, familiarly known as MythCon. We have a bunch of people here with us today. We have this is the Saturday night at MythCon, so we have we're halfway through the conference now. We've been going for a day and a half, and we're looking forward to another full day tomorrow. So we just wanted to kind of chat about what's going on at MythCon, what we've been seeing so far, and say hi to some of the awesome people who are here. I am joined here this evening by a number of cool people. We have four Mythgard students. We have Chris Swank. Say hi, Chris.
Hi, Chris.
Very good. We have Luke Bogger.
It's actually Boar.
Boar? Really? So here I am meeting Luke in person for the first time this week, and not only that, but also learning how correctly to pronounce his name. Boar?
Yeah. Really? As an English teacher, I always told the students, it's like a person who talks for way too long.
Right. Right. Okay. Yeah, that's best to own it, really.
Yeah. That way they can't make the joke. Yeah.
Right, exactly. Exactly. Cool. And Kat Sass is here.
Hello.
And Serena Higgins.
Good evening.
That's right. Mythgard student who is joining the faculty this fall. Yeah. She's going to be precepting Lewis and Tolkien this fall with me. So we're very excited. We also are joined by special guest Paula DeSantos here.
DeSanti.
Well,
that's
yes.
Pretty close.
I was like one letter away.
What is that?
That's very good. Yeah, it's awesome to have Paula join us. Paula, who spontaneously joined us for our previous MythCon broadcast 3 years ago and came by again tonight. That was awesome.
I crashed the party, yeah.
That's right. And also Carl Hostetter.
Yeah.
Very good. So what are your sort of general responses to MythCon so far? What have been some of your favorite things that have been happening at the conference so far?
Michael Drout's lecture on Beowulf, I think.
Yeah.
I forget who said it first, but that was kind of worth the price of admission right there.
Yeah. It was really great that he did that on the first night too. You know, he's talking about Tolkien's Beowulf and, in his beginning, he explained that he hadn't been planning to give the lecture, but decided, had been told that if he didn't give the talk on it, he'd be giving it 24 different times as he explained it to everybody who came up and asked him, because certainly, you know, lots of people want to know what Mike thinks of Tolkien's translation and the publication. So he told the whole story of sort of the history with him and the Beowulf translation and the Tolkien estate, and so we got to hear kind of the whole backstory of that, and then he gave his assessment of the translation and the commentaries. It was really, really cool.
Well, I think anytime you can get a scholar talking about their forte. And especially when they bring props. Yes. Kind of makes the whole experience worth it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Other thoughts? Other things that you've seen and enjoyed? You want to tell people about some of the stuff that happens here at MythCon?
Since I've been coming here for a very long time, it's just great to see friends. This is the family reunion I get to have with friends once
right.
a year,
right.
And it's wonderful. I love it, and in a beautiful location. This is really lovely campus. Mm-hmm. Just love walking around and just taking it in.
Yeah, it's a beautiful little New England small college campus. We're at Wheaton College this year, which is Mike Drouth's school. He's hosting it this year, and it's been fantastic.
It's great to have a lot of new people here. I mean, a lot. I love it. This is exactly what we need to do, is keep bringing new people in. So it's been wonderful to have everybody here.
I think somewhere between a third and a half of the people here are new, which is wonderful. So.
Yeah. And not only that, but presenting papers. I was in a session today where the presenter said that he first read Tolkien as a serious scholarly piece of literature a year and a half ago. And he's here presenting a paper on Sigurd and Gudrun, and that was really exciting.
Wow.
So that's not that like the go-to one that you think of
right.
when you think of new Tolkien readers. But
boy, talk about like jumping in with both feet. Huh?
And he did, and he did a great job, yeah.
That's fantastic.
And even the generation subsequent to that is an appearance here, because Chip Crane's two young boys actually gave a paper,
right.
Which they may have the record for the youngest presenters, and it was really good.
Yeah,
it was very well done.
They were what, like, how old are they?
Oh,
eight?
Maybe? One of them's like 10 and 10.
8 and 10,
something
yeah.
like that.
Yeah.
Can you give us the short version of their paper?
Well, they looked at, I think it was called something like the power in naming. And so they look at the use of names as a means of identifying, of controlling, of having power over individuals, knowing their real history, who they really are. And even also the power of unnaming. They mm-hmm. brought out some examples in various fantasy books where characters are actually have their names removed, eradicated mm-hmm. from history, which is a really kind of a creepy thing to think about. Yeah. So it was very well done.
Excellent.
I was sad I didn't get to see that one, because that's something that I've thought about fairly often, that in a mythological sense, often naming something is having power over that thing. You know, and I really wanted to see their take on it, but it was just happening at the same time as a couple other interesting things that I had to go to.
I.e. your panel.
Yes, that's right.
An interesting panel on teaching Tolkien at the college level. And I like that covered teaching higher level classes, where you can really delve into some of the more difficult texts, and then people were asking questions about how do you teach this to students who aren't ready for that level. What if it's a freshman composition class, or a class that maybe has some students with some remedial reading needs, and so forth. And that was really inspiring and practical. And I've liked in that panel, and also in Michael Drought's, how we saw examples of really great teaching. People who are so passionate about the literature, they're able to give a very scholarly presentation but without making it dry and without stripping it of the love of the literature.
Mm-hmm. And that panel was interesting to me, because in 1978 I took a class on Tolkien at the University of Michigan. And the professor's name is Thomas Toon, and he looked like Tom Bombadil. He was wonderful. And that class was packed. I mean, I was like, oh, please let me get in. And I did, and I loved it. But it's a little distressing that it's still taken this long for it to become more common. Mm-hmm. And at least it is, but that's kind of a long haul. So.
Yeah. Right. Well, that's the perspective that Verlin Flieger brings to it, is you realize, you know, when people ask, is the climate changing? And you kind of say, well, a little bit, you know, like, you know, but incrementally, but you realize she's been having that fight for 40 years, you know, and
yeah.
still having it and everything. So it really gives you a sense of the history.
Yeah, exactly. I was sitting, you know, she's like, I taught my first Tolkien class in 1974. And I was like,
I was born in 1974.
Yeah. So instead of like, and I get to go after that, you know, like,
well, my vast wealth of experience compared to Verlin Flieger.
Though it is always my perversely my favorite moment in that panel was the person who asked the question about, is the climate getting better? And I, you know, she seemed to be asking it with a certain amount of like hope and optimism, and Verlin and I are like, no. Not really. and it's changing in that there are more people who are coming up and doing it, but as far as like the top down attitude hasn't changed.
And you said even the change there is often about the practicalities of getting butts in seats, as it
exactly,
is about like a change of actual perspective.
Oh, man, you should hear Thomas Shippey talk about that. you know, Tom Shippey is like, you know, he says, you know, the only reason they teach Tolkien now is because they're trying to survive, because they're all about to die. And I say, good. They deserve it. Just fantastic. It is quite a, in fact, I called it a disreputable reason, which I think that was a shippy term for it. There are many, you know, people coming up through, you know, there are many younger people entering academia, you know, who have a different perspective on it. But there's still a lot of people who have to die before it changes really dramatically. I mean, I'm sorry, but that's just the fact of the matter.
Just say the same thing more optimistically. When those students grow up. And
exactly.
Go to
absolutely.
When they become faculty, then they'll be ready to.
Not that I'm hankering for the death of those people. But
it's true. If they're talking about butts and seats, the students that are coming through right now crave this kind of stuff. They want to have classes on The Hunger Games and Divergent and all of the genre literature. And it's the administration that's saying, well, we don't know if we can transfer that. We don't know if we can accredit that. We're not quite sure how to give you credit for that. And if they would just do it, they would have the people enrolling for those classes.
No, and, you know, really, I mean, you can see it as a symptom of a bigger thing. I mean, especially the 20th century, literature people, you know, who have been, you know, sort of trying to defend the canon against popular fiction of any kind, and Tolkien is kind of the bugbear of that. You know, all the stories about the people who keep releasing polls about the most influential book of the century keep trying to rephrase it so that Tolkien doesn't win, you know, and failing every time.
Well, I have a question for you, because that was just a few years ago when it was named the book of the century. Were your colleagues' heads exploding when that happened?
They just dismiss it. I mean, because this is the thing. If you dismiss Tolkien on the grounds that it's popular, you know, it's one of those arguments that's impossible to lose, right? You know, like basically any evidence that you can bring forward to show that it's worth studying is not only can be discounted, but is used as evidence against the position. See, the fact that it's, you know, if I try to say, for instance, as I was initially, you know, in my own teaching career, saying, hey, you know, it's really accessible. It's a way to make this stuff accessible. Accessibility is no argument in favor of something.
Right, that's a dumbing down.
Exactly. You're not going to convince a lot of modernists by saying, but it's so accessible. Mm-hmm.
Then the inverse argument is, you know, if you try to argue, well, just because it's popular doesn't mean it's not good. Look at Charles Dickens and those people, and they say, oh, well, that's because that work is complicated. And then you say, well, have you read it? And they say, no. It's like, well, then how can you say it's not complicated?
Yes. Yeah, no, former colleague of mine with whom I had most arguments about Tolkien and who was most vehement against my including it, near the end of our discussion, admitted to having never read it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I was like, and it's always something that I've marveled at. You know, there aren't that many things which an academic will make a vehement argument against and confess openly, simultaneously, that they've never read it.
Right.
You know, normally they'll at least fake it if they're going to argue against it. Right? But that, I mean, who would make an argument against, I mean, there are some things, like Twilight comes to mind. People make arguments against Twilight when they've never read it, you know, which is why I read it, so that I could make arguments without feeling conspicuous. But, as I've said before, my assessment of Twilight is very simple. Boring. But anyway, but Tolkien, they'll just sort of pile on without data. It's really puzzling to me.
It seems that happens more with genre things, that it does seem to be that they have something against the concept of it rather than against the thing itself, you know.
Right.
It's not about, I've read it and I, you know, think it's no good for this reason. It's something about that kind of thing that is just a turnoff, I think.
Yeah.
Well, this kind of brings me to Luke's paper, which was, he was looking at some spiritual criticism of fantasy and how that's out of fashion. And so even the people that look at fantasy don't want to look at it as an in-depth kind of something that has layers and something that you can talk about these deep issues with, that the people want to talk about it on the surface of, you know, how pretty Legolas's hair is rather than the spiritual element. And so you get to talk about your paper now, because that was a nice intro.
Well, the paper I presented today is actually about 10 years old. I started writing it as a research paper my junior year in high school. And at that point, you know, that was the classic, you have to have 100 different reference note cards for your research paper. And so then after that, I revisited it several times and threw away all the bad high school argumentation and updated the sources. But the new component to that paper is I realized through that lengthy process that we don't have academic spiritual criticism of Tolkien. We have what you could call religious studies of right. Tolkien, where someone's trying to put it into a spiritual lens and claim it to be a spiritual work.
Devotional works exactly. from Tolkien.
Right. Exactly. Right. But you don't have someone just critiquing the archetypal elements within a literary framework. And so that's the overarching idea of the paper, and what I presented today was just kind of part of the case study of what that could look like. There's still a lot left to be done on that paper before it's anywhere near anything, but it's a fun challenge.
Could you explain that phrase a little bit more, the academic spiritual criticism?
Well, in the paper I say, you know, you kind of have three different things that spiritual criticism kind of does at this point. It either tries to make claims about the author's personal belief and say, well, they're Christian, so it's a Christian work, and so let's just say that the whole thing's a Christian work, and let's analyze it as theology. Mm-hmm. Or then they try to make the entire thing a religious allegory, and again, let's analyze it as theology. Or the last thing is that they come to it with a very personal thing. Anna Marie Grazello's book yeah. does this. It's, you know, this part of the text spoke to me at this point, and this part of the text spoke to me at this point. And so while that is a valid study within the religious field, it's not academic criticism. It's spiritual criticism of a sort, religious criticism. And so it's the major point is to keep your criticism within the context of the text itself, because it's that archetype informing your interpretation of the text, that should be the end goal. It shouldn't be to make the text into something that it's not, or to squeeze the text into your own interpretation. And so it really is just kind of a very tenuous argument in that you're going to get attacked from both sides with that one. I will say, as a first-time conference attendee anywhere, and as a first-time presenter anywhere, it has been really miraculous, the reception I received. I came here expecting maybe 5 people in a room. You know, I was like, okay, I can do that. And there were 20 or 30. And there were people sitting on the floor. And I was like, okay, this is more than I anticipated. And, you know, I got some very nice constructive criticism that I can take back and strengthen my paper and hone my arguments, and but didn't feel personally attacked, didn't feel affronted, anything like that. It was a very nice experience.
We don't bite usually.
So that was yesterday. That was the second session of papers. Did anyone go to any of the first session papers? Was anyone
yes.
here?
Yes, and I'll jump off of what you said and then talk about one of those papers okay. as well. I think you were illustrating something really, really important in Tolkien studies and Inkling studies in general, that we're kind of just entering the third generation of scholars, that people like yourself who are just presenting are kind of the third important wave. And so Inkling scholarship is just starting to grow up, I think. So we had a first generation during and right after their lives that was mostly summary, introduction, presentation, and then appreciation. Mm-hmm. So papers then would be sort of, look at how great this book is. Let me tell you what it's all about and what a great book it is. This is especially true in C.S. Lewis studies. Mm-hmm. And then the second generation tried to be a little bit more theoretically rigorous, and I think that was easier to do with Tolkien than the others because he provides such fertile ground for that. But the languages, the linguistics, people jumped on that. But now we need to go even further and be more rigorous and look at the work that's been done before, which you were just saying. We don't just want to summarize the text and appreciate them. We want to find deep structures and deep interpretive ways. of approaching them. So there have been a few papers that have done that, some that were older scholars who had that wealth of experience, like the keynote speech that we heard this morning, maybe we can talk about. In the first session, I went to Brenton Dickinson's paper about C.S. Lewis, where he presented some material on a newly published preface that he's just published to the Screwtape Letters, and was talking about how can we approach imaginative universes, speculative fiction, how can we look at it in a much more profound way, looking at the science of it and the astronomy in it and the cosmological elements.
Yeah, just to, for people who know C.S. Lewis, this was, I think, to me, the single most mind-blowing. I had not heard of this, and it was the single most mind-blowing thing I have learned at this conference, which is that there was a deleted section of the original preface to Lewis's Screwtape Letters, wherein he explained that the original documents of, you know, the transcript of Screwtape and his letters to Wormwood was written in Old Solar and translated by Ransom. So he was explicitly connecting the Screwtape Letters to the Space Trilogy, which is still blowing my mind when I think about it. Like, I'm still trying to process that.
It opens
that.
Such enormous possibilities.
Oh,
ways
goodness.
Of looking at the language, ways of looking at the universe that's being created, ideas about hell and how the fallen angels are related to the Eldilla, on and on.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. I can't even begin to formulate my thoughts about changing the way I'm looking at Screwtape by thinking about Lewis making that connection. It's just incredible.
And where is this published? Do you remember?
The preface itself is published in Notes and Queries. So that's just the text of the preface. You can read a little bit more about the project on his blog, A Pilgrim in Narnia.
Okay.
But he hasn't published all of this material yet.
Cool.
Yeah. He found that at the Wade,
yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's a very Tolkienian exercise. I always think of Lewis's fictional world as very connected thematically, but separate from each other. Whereas it seems like Tolkien's the one who wants to draw everything in and make
yes.
the connections, and it seems like he had those similar impulses. And then when you add in, you know, in the introduction to, is it Out of the Silent Planet with the or. Which one of the Space Trilogy books that makes reference to Numenor and everything?
That Hideous Strength.
So yeah. That kind of connecting between the different
yeah.
world that he was building and everything.
Yeah, and that's exactly why I found it so mind-blowing. Because, you know, whereas, you know, Tolkien is, you know, not in every case, but in so many cases, doing the whole, you know, Niggle's tree thing and, you know, tacking his, you know, small paintings onto the edges of his big painting. Lewis generally doesn't do that. So, I mean, that's why, you know, I'd literally never, ever, it would never have occurred to me in my entire life to think of Screwtape and the Eldilla in anything other than like a contrasting two totally different ideas of Lewis's. The idea that he was kind of mashing them together in that way is really fascinating.
And for more on that topic, come to the Inklings and King Arthur panel tomorrow.
Yes, sir. Because this is the panel, the King Arthur panel tomorrow is contributors for your book, right?
That's right.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. That would be a segue for you to talk about your book.
This is a collection that I'm editing of chapters about the Inkling's Arthurian works. So we have a large section in the book that gives context and backgrounds, talking about spiritual quest in a scientific era, talking about Arthurian literature all the way from the earliest works up until the 20th century and some of their predecessors. And then large sections on Tolkien, Lewis, and Williams.
Nice.
So tomorrow four of my chapter writers are presenting little pieces of their research.
So who are your confirmed chapter writers?
Well, there are 24 of them, so I will not run through, but some that are relevant for this group. Robin Ann Reed is writing one, and she's doing a grammatical stylistics analysis of the landscapes in Tolkien's The Fall of Arthur. So she's one of those people who's looking at it from a modernist perspective instead
right.
of medievalist perspective, so that's great. Holly Ordway from Houston Baptist is doing the chapter on Arthurian background literature. Malcolm Geit is doing the conclusion, in which he looks at the Inklings as prophets who are looking forward into the future and how their Arthurian works are anticipating future themes and works. So a few samples.
So you'll be at MythCon next year when it's Arthurian theme.
I hope all the chapter writers will come next year, and just the whole MythCon will be like, you think it's your Arthur book, right?
So in the next session, we had Janet Brennan-Croft present a couple papers early on. Did anyone go to either of those?
I went to the naming one.
Oh, you did?
I missed most of the early ones because I was late on Friday, so I didn't.
You were recording your...
Yeah, I was doing Riddles in the Dark in the morning and then driving down after that. So yeah, I was delayed. I was delayed.
You arrived precisely when you mentioned it. It sounds like, from Carl's summary, it sounds that it was covering very similar material to what the little boys presented on the power of names and who gets to choose their names and what happens when someone is unnamed. But she was looking at it more from a feminist perspective about when women have the authority and power of naming either themselves or someone else. She was looking at it in Buffy and some other.
What I love about this conference is that you can go from a session on Buffy to a session on Neil Gaiman to a session on ABC's Once Upon a Time to Tolkien. I mean, it's just really very eclectic, and there's something for everybody that likes fantasy and genre TV and literature, so and film. It's it feeds all parts of your soul.
I'm waiting for the first Sharknado paper,
though. You need to write that. And Sharknado and King Arthur makes me so
It's a very natural crossover. It really is.
The return of Sharknado.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, as Michael Drouth said about MythCon quite aptly, we're an academic conference with one-third the pomposity.
Right.
So it makes for a lot of fun.
Yeah. It is one thing I've always appreciated. You know, it's as a medievalist, I, sort of grew up in conferences at Kalamazoo. You know, Kalamazoo was always the conference. And, of course, it's a great Tolkien conference, too. And there are really great panels and wonderful people at Kalamazoo, but it's a huge, huge academic conference. And as a medievalist, you know, grad student and everything, it's always, you know, there's always this like, I gotta go to Kalamazoo and make my bones. And you're looking out of the, you know, the corner of your eye at other people. And, you know, there's always, you know, it's very much more of that, like, you know, and, you know, the fear and trembling, you know, when like, is that Larry Benson over there? You know, I mean, just like when, you know, the great scholars walk by and you're in awe. And it's very refreshingly different atmosphere here.
Yet there's always Tolkien at Kalamazoo as well. So
exactly,
running concurrently, you know, there's always a room where you can go to Tolkien.
Yeah, those are really good. And again, there's you know, in those panels, there's a very different atmosphere. I mean, it's very, you know, the whole community, I think, is very different.
How large is that conference?
Kalamazoo?
In terms of
5,000 participants.
Wow.
Usually 500 to 600 panels.
I live in Michigan. I had no idea.
It's amazing. You can watch swords being made in the morning.
Oh my goodness.
And it's great because there are monks and nuns, like actual monks and nuns, not cosplayers, but
right,
walking around with their, you know, iPhones checking stuff, and it's just mind-blowing the things that you can do there. But my first year at Kalamazoo, I went to this panel, and there was a woman who made one of the speakers cry. And I turned to somebody, and I said, wow, that's really harsh. And they said, oh, no, she does that every year. And if you write...
Oh, her. No, I know just who
you
mean. Yes, I do.
If you write on this certain topic...
Uh-huh.
Her goal is to break you, and we just don't have that sort of thing at MythCon.
No.
It's just, it's not nasty at all at MythCon. It's
yes.
Very nice. So,
we're going to send out the press gangs to see if there's anybody else we can drag in. We had a really fun exercise tonight. We were doing Beowulf aloud. We were reading Beowulf selections from Beowulf, both in Anglo-Saxon and in Tolkien's new translation. That was a lot of fun. It was really great to hear Tolkien's translation read aloud. You know, I was thinking when Michael Drouth commented on it, when he said, "Now that I'm hearing it aloud, I think better of it than when I was just reading it off the page."
Mm-hmm.
And I had been kind of thinking that last night, actually, at his talk, because it's, I'm always thinking of things aloud. I always like to read things aloud. I'm a very, very audio person. It was, I do think that it has, you can hear his sensitivity to sound, even though it is, you know, kind of ornate and complex prose in places. But I think that the sound structure works really, really well.
I think it was interesting, just again, as someone new to the convention, to see how many people were courageous enough to get up there and do it in Old English. And it has to be said that it's particularly daunting when you're around people who have studied this stuff and yeah. know you if you're doing it wrong. So
yeah, absolutely. Luke and I and Carl all did read in Anglo-Saxon, and it was cold reading, like sight reading. Anglo-Saxon is really hard. It's really hard. I love reading Anglo-Saxon if I can have a significant amount of time to practice, the passage that I'm going to do. But that was really challenging.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't know why I was surprised. I shouldn't have been at the amount of people that knew Old English well enough to get up and do that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Another great feature that occurred today was the incorporation of the people from Turbine.
Yeah.
That was, I think that was a huge draw, because I looked around the theater when they were presenting, and it was a very young crowd, you know, much, much younger than, I mean, you hear academic conference and you think, oh, these are all a bunch of tenured professors and that's the age range, but there were a lot of college-aged kids here to see and interact with the people who designed and developed the game.
Yeah, it was interesting to listen to them and talk about how they're doing it a piece at a time and how far back it's been in production. I mean, and then they have another 7 years to go.
I've always been, everything I've always heard about Lord of the Rings Online, I've never played it yet. I've been holding off. But I've always been impressed by everything I've heard. And I was actually listening to them, was fascinating. I mean, I think that the connection between the kind of world building that they're doing, and the way that, and I was especially impressed at how they're thinking of the kind of narratives that they're building and the way that they're incorporating story, the interplay between Tolkien's written text, the themes of Tolkien's written text, the details of his descriptions and everything, and then, the narrative and the story that they make and sort of fill in around the edges, going to places which we never see or only very rarely hear about and everything. I thought that was really fascinating, and I really have a lot of respect for the thought that they're doing.
They're developing it chronologically, correct?
Yes.
So they're saying it's opening up more now that they've got certain things established.
Well, and they're following the path of the Fellowship, and kind of the higher you get in the game, the farther you can go along that path. One of the great things I love about their process, though, is no one said it in the presentation, and I really wish they had. They're being sub-creators.
Yes.
They're taking the little germs that Tolkien gave them, and they're fleshing it out to make a story.
Yes.
And I think that's miraculous. I think it's, honestly, I think it would make Tolkien happy to see that, because it's the exact same kind of process that he likes to see.
Yeah.
And so I thought that was awesome.
Yeah. Well, is it a similar size group of people who play across the world, like to World of Warcraft? I know, which is humongous. Is it similar in size? Or?
They were asked that afterwards when they were mm-hmm. small group congregated, and he said, actually, it's kind of a closely guarded secret as to how many. But what they could say is that World of Warcraft at its peak had over around 10 million, and they've come down since then. And Lord of the Rings Online has never gotten close to that.
Okay.
So that's about as much as you could say.
The one thing I heard a while is that they have several million, though. I mean, so we're like, they haven't reached 10 million, but
right.
they're in that order of magnitude, basically. I mean, when I first heard of Lord of the Rings Online, I have to admit that I made the assumption that it was going to be the kind of cheap knockoff that almost every Tolkien video game I'd ever seen had been. You know, I've always loved video games, I never played Tolkien video games because they always annoyed me. You know, I mean, the sort of pseudo-Tolkien framework, which was rarely more than paper thin on the surface, I found it completely distracting. You know, I would much rather play a different game that was not pretending to sort of go in that direction. And I have to admit that I assumed that this was going to be, you know, it's like, okay, it's World of Warcraft with Tolkien trademarks. Okay. That was the assumption I made at the beginning. But the more I heard from people who played it, and the more I learned about it, the more impressed I was. But even knowing, you know, even having learned a good deal about it and having talked to a lot of people who played it, I was still impressed hearing them talk. It was great to hear the Turbine guys. We're fortunate we're in Massachusetts this year, so Turbine is like a few miles away, so their chief lore monkey, as he titles himself, came down, and it was great to hear about his process. They showed us my favorite, and of course they were showing a lot of the visuals, which were just stunning. Dol Amroth is gorgeous, but my favorite visual that they showed was the spreadsheet that he made. They went through and he did a like a moment by moment spreadsheet correlating, like when Tolkien made reference to particular meteorological phenomena during the battle and what was happening in other places at the same time, you know, so that when they did that battle, because basically you sort of play it in the game. You never play one of the main Fellowship characters. So, you know, you're able to, like, you're like one of the people helping to round up the Arkenbrand's warriors to come to the assistance of them at Helm's Deep. So, you know, when you get that, all of the events are coordinated properly so that, you know, it works out just as it's scripted, in the book. And the detail of everything that they had of, like, you know, Legolas kills orc number 12. And it was really intricate.
That was really, like, by minute, a running tally of orc kills for Legolas and Gimli on the two right-hand columns.
Yeah.
Some of the process plotting a murder mystery.
Exactly. Yeah, it was like 502, Legolas 12, right. Gimli 5.
Yeah.
And I noticed the color coding was that for different aspects.
I couldn't interpret all of the different ways, but yeah, because, you know, they're having different cutscenes between different parts of the battle and everything, so, you know, trying to make sure to correlate all that carefully. And again, I mean, you know, obviously there's lots of scope to disagree with their interpretation, or, you know, when they do, you know, their own sub-creation and are filling things in, you know, there's lots of opportunity to disagree with the stuff that they said, or that they've written. But, you know, you can't challenge, you know, you can't question their passion, you know, for the text, and that, you know, they're being really, really thorough in what they do.
Not slapped together.
Not at all. And that was, they have my great respect for that. Well, we've been joined by several more guests here. So let me introduce people here, and maybe I should have you introduce yourselves here briefly.
Chris Larson, professor of astronomy at Central Connecticut State University.
Excellent. Yes, Chris was on the panel with me, the Teaching Tolkien panel this morning. We were talking about that a little bit earlier.
Jewel Morrow, retired librarian.
Excellent.
And Richard West, retired librarian from the University of Wisconsin. And the guest of honor at this one of the guests of honor.
Yes, we're very glad to have you with us, Richard. Richard gave his plenary address this morning, which was wonderful. It was a great sort of over. You want to talk a little bit about, sort of share with people a little bit about what you were talking about?
All right. Well, since I was a scholar guest of honor, I was to give the keynote address on the conference theme, which is Where Fantasy Fits. I gave it the subtitle, The Importance of Being Tolkien, because I was sort of giving an overview of fantasy from Gilgamesh to the present day, which is sort of in perhaps overly ambitious.
I jumped around
a lot. But I was talking in the 20th century, realistic novel had become you know, dominant in the much of the 19th and 20th centuries, although there was always some fantasy. But there was, after World War I, there was very little fantasy published until Tolkien. Tolkien was the game changer. And a lot of this was simply, there was change in taste, change in the zeitgeist. After the First World War, people were not, for whatever reason, when the fantasy, as Tolkien said, went into the nursery, it wasn't in the, it wasn't considered quite proper for adults. So it went into pulp magazines, lowbrow publications instead of into adult literature, until Tolkien, which the publisher actually thought, well, this is a work of genius, but we'll lose £1,000 if we publish it. But it's so good, we're going to publish it anyway. And which I think is what happened. I gave examples of some of the major fantasies between the end of World War I and Tolkien, and essentially they all had the same problem. They were just so good that they got published. But they didn't sell very well in most cases. With Tolkien, he sold very well from the beginning, and part of it was, as Northrop Frye, one of our great theoretical critics, says, there was a change in taste again, and he came along at the right time to take advantage of it, and he was just so good that he became so influential on other fantasy. And he was good, although he's often called a high fantasy, he fantasy about heroes. He wrote practically every type of fantasy, comic fantasy, dark fantasy. I think urban fantasy is about the only type that I can't give an example of Tolkien did better than most people who came after him.
Yeah. And, Minas Tirith doesn't quite count as urban fantasy.
Right. So I gave examples pre-Tolkien, after Tolkien. It was also arguing there is this, what I could call, this is a false myth rather than a true myth, that Tolkien came out and it was okay, but it wasn't until it came out in paperback that people took notice, and the big scholarship started. And I said, "This is not true. He was selling well in hardcover. His publisher told him the royalties are going to give you a comfortable retirement." The book was selling, and they said within the first 10 years, there was a major master's thesis just on Tolkien, four PhD dissertations, in which Tolkien was a substantial section, and the others tended to be related authors like C.S. Lewis and Charles Williams, and at least 11 major articles in scholarly or at least intellectual journals, which were very good. Most of them were reprinted later when they started doing collections of the good essays on Tolkien. Mm-hmm. So he was already a critical success, already an academic success before the paperback. The paperback simply meant that what was a successful novel became a phenomenally successful novel.
Right.
And it just took off and never went back. And other writers took advantage of this. They now had a market for the fantasy that they would like to do. But he was also got imitated a lot, and sometimes that was very bad. But many people then sort of emulated him and said, well, he's done all this wonderful stuff with world mythology, but mostly it's Norse and Celtic. I'll do Australian Aborigine, like Patricia Wrightson. But she'd read Tolkien, and she said, I'm going to structure it the way he did. I'm not just going to write a novel with Australian Aboriginal mythology. I will actually look at the real mythology and set it. This tale belongs in this part of the country. This tale belongs in that part. She actually got into trouble with the Australian Aborigines and had to stop doing it because they felt she as a white person, was using their mythology without their permission. And the decided to withdraw permission, so she stopped doing that kind of thing. She was a very good writer in Australia. And others, like Terry Pratchett, who was the best-selling author in England until J.K. Rowling came around and displaced everybody. She is the only author I know of who's become a billionaire by writing novels. It was good. So that was somewhat an overview.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, we've just been sort of, you know, talking about, the things that we've seen and panels that we've been to and sort of impressions and thoughts just to kind of share with people who couldn't be here at MythCon some of the things that we saw and heard. Anything particularly striking that you would want to share? Anything, you know, sort of favorite parts of today or yesterday or things you're looking forward to tomorrow?
No, putting on the spot. not to do a little commercialization for myself, but I will because I'm given the chance. I'm doing a paper tomorrow on magical weapons in, it's advertised as the Silmarillion and Game of Thrones, but I'm also talking about Witcher and Dominion as well. So that'll be fun. I brought some meteorite samples with me and some iron ore samples with me to pass around and talk about. So
there's going to be a talk on the science of magic weapons.
Sort of, yeah.
Yeah, awesome.
He's our scientist.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I was going to tell you. It was too irrelevant for me to excuse bringing it in our panel this morning. But I had a physics student who really wanted to do her thesis on Tolkien and to sort of integrate, you know, looking at doing like an English physics dual thesis, looking at the fall of Numenor. And thinking about like the switch from Cartesian to spherical coordinate systems and the correlation of that with a literary moment, but she couldn't sell it to either the physics or the English department, unfortunately. But anyway, I was thinking that you were making me remember her this morning when you were talking about, because you teach science, right? You're a science professor who is a Tolkienist and teach on Tolkien and you do direct crossover, right? You say you do classes on sort of science and Tolkien. What are some of the things that you focus on in your science and Tolkien classes?
Well, I try to do the Silmarillion chronologically from the beginning. So I start with the beginnings of science and creation myths and go on and talk about the chapter on the creation of the sun and the moon and talk about calendars and how horribly messy they are and how Tolkien actually derived his own calendars, which he was very proud. The Numenorean calendar was more precise than the Gregorian calendar. In one of the letters he talks about that. He's really proud of that. And also talk about Tolkien's descriptions of volcanoes and also the whole tension about science and technology. Mm-hmm. That some people have this mistaken impression that Tolkien was anti-science.
Right.
And he's not. And he talks in several letters about Tom Bombadil being the embodiment of this pure scientific spirit who just wants to know versus technology, which talks about dominion and usefulness and power.
Right.
And so I really want to drive that home to the students that, you know, like people will say that Einstein is responsible for the atomic bomb. Well, Einstein did say E equals MC squared. He did not say, take this and we'll blow people up with it. So you have to really look at the difference between science just as a way of knowing about the world that you're a part of and what you do with that knowledge.
Yeah. Other thoughts? Anything people are looking forward to in the next day? We have the banquet tomorrow, right?
Costume contest, yes.
Usually, the majority of scholarly conferences do not, in fact, feature a costume contest. So that is yet another way in which MythCon is pleasantly different.
Except they don't play golf and
bowling.
Carl and I are looking forward to another panel tomorrow afternoon on faith and fantasy.
I'm looking forward to going to that.
Well, I was invited to join because I'm a Tolkienist, of course, although not nearly as accomplished as some of the other people here, because my own focus, as many people will know, is on Tolkien's invented languages. But another area of intense interest on my part that I've developed for a number of years now is on what I think of as the metaphysics of Middle Earth, and both as Tolkien was a Roman Catholic, as am I, and that actually, as I've come to educate myself over the past decade or so, looking into Thomas Aquinas and the sort of the rich intellectual history of the behind Catholicism, to which Tolkien was heir, I've become convinced that there's actually quite a lot of Tolkien's Catholicism expressed in the metaphysics of Middle-earth. So, because from my point of view, Catholicism is not just a system of beliefs, but it's also an anthropology, a cosmology, a worldview. And if you look at it at that level, you can see a lot of Catholic metaphysical thought expressed at some level, sometimes implicit, sometimes more explicit, in Tolkien's Legendarium. So that's actually an area that I've been exploring, and hope someday to actually have something to publish on that. But I'll probably talk about that some on the panel tomorrow. As I can. So, yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to that. This is sort of a new area for me to explore. So,
yeah, we were asked to address on that whether the writers were discussing show faith explicitly in their works. Like, for instance, do they show specific rituals? Do they show characters going to church or doing anything like that? And then what implicit ways? And then we're supposed to also look at whether we think that's successful, whether that adds to or detracts from the work. So I know that Lynn Maudlin is planning to talk about Harry Potter and expressions of religion in Harry Potter that she thinks detract from the story. So I'll be interested to see how she supports that.
Yeah.
And I'm going to talk about Charles Williams and some of his implicit and explicit expressions, both of his Anglican faith and of his occult involvement.
Yeah. And of course, Tolkien, rather famously, there are no explicit expressions of religion in the Legendarium. But that doesn't mean that religion is absent. So.
Other than the metal Tara.
Yes, that's right. And Faramir's
prayer. Faramir's prayer, yeah, exactly.
And of Gollum worshipping Shelob.
Yeah. Oh. Although, I mean, I would make the case, for instance, that Samwise invoking Varda, Elbereth. And Sindarin, Atironim Funuilos, look towards us, look towards me, Funuilos. I mean, to a lifelong Catholic, you can't hear that and not think of the Catholic prayer that says to Mary, turn then, most gracious advocate, thine eyes of mercy towards us. I mean, it's exactly the same sort of invocation of someone to look at us and aid us. So it that's why I say it's not really explicit. You have to know some Elvish to really know. Tolkien did provide notes, but not within the Lord of the Rings itself as to what that meant. And it was in The Road Goes Ever On later. But if you start teasing these things out, it's there, and I think it's interesting. So at least I hope others will find it so too.
Well, say I'm looking forward to our other guest of honor speech, Ursula Vernon, because I really loved her graphic novel Digger, which I thought was just wonderfully funny, but wonderfully mythic. The poor little digger tunnels up into the temple of Lord Ganesh, the talking statue, who says, I am. Basically, an avatar of the god Ganesh. I can provide you with various theological arguments for my existence, which never happened because it's a joke. But the book is just beautifully drawn. So we can't show that on the
right,
very, very, very funny, but very, very moving. Also, there was a very good paper on it yesterday. By Lisa Paddle, which is good for going through the book and the moral qualities of the book and the moral questions that are addressed about good and evil and what Digger just wants to get home gives up his best, her, sorry, her best chance to get home because she has to deal with the threat that will otherwise hurt a lot of people in that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's one thing I've always admired about MythCon as well. Another thing that I think really makes it different from most scholarly conferences is the dual focus on criticism and writing. You know, how there's a scholarly guest of honor and an author guest of honor every year, which is kind of refreshing, really. You know, it's like we're not just going to sit around and talk about literature. We'll actually invite people who really write literature as well.
Is she giving a reading or talking about her book? Do we know?
I don't know yet. She will be giving a talk.
Yeah.
So presumably,
yeah, she'll
read her.
Probably not without reference to the book, I hope. But yeah.
Well, and another thing that may not have been mentioned yet. Speaking of books that are being honored, mm-hmm. you, our very own Corey Olson has one nominated. It's his seminal work on The Hobbit. and did you want to give a quick plug for your book?
I've probably given enough plugs on my own podcast and of course the people who listen to my podcast heard like the proto version of my book anyway. In fact, in the acknowledgement to my book, I thanked the listeners of my podcast to whom I owe my book because it was their responses to my discussions of The Hobbit that both led me to write it and led a publisher to publish it. So, but anyway, yeah, and my Exploring the Hobbit book, is nominated for the Mythopoeic Award in Inkling Studies, which is a wonderful honor. It was, nominated last year too, which was a great honor, and I was so delighted to see Verlin win. Last year was funny. Last year, I couldn't be here last year because I was actually moving into my new house on the weekend of MythCon. I was like getting tweets from people at MythCon while I was carrying boxes up the stairs. but you know, last year I was like 100% sure that Verlin was going to win. Like I was like, that was, that clearly justice needed to be done there. So I basically threw the party when it was nominated, and I was like that. You know. But anyways, it is certainly an honor to be nominated. So, you know, that will be fun, and they do it very suspensefully here. You know, many people have asked me about it, sort of assuming that, because you know, as is often the case, like you know, the winner is told in advance, and it's a secret to everybody else. And it's a secret to me too. I have no idea.
Have you prepared both acceptance and rejection speeches?
I haven't really planned. It's not like I've written an acceptance speech because I can't help but think that scripting an acceptance speech is a bad idea. You know, I mean, it's like
bad karma.
Well, sort of. You know, yeah, to say, like, I'm now going to spend an entire evening, like,
assuming that I am going to win and, you know, crafting the remarks, the clever remarks I'm going to make when that inevitable moment occurs. It just never doesn't really seem right. So, you know,
so you're not going to pull an Emma Thompson and do, like, in the character of Bilbo Baggins?
Well, see, I haven't planned it, so who knows? Anything could happen there, but...
Yeah. Picking up on what you were saying earlier about the dual focus on creative and academic writing, there are four categories of books nominated. So there are two scholarly. There's the Award for Inkling Studies and then General Myth and Fantasy Studies. And then they do also Fantasy Adult Literature and Fantasy Children's Literature.
Yeah.
Covers those.
Yeah, that's great. Ed Powell, who's joined us online, was saying that since I've not planned a speech, it means I will give the longest acceptance speech in MythCon history.
Don't pull a Sally Fields and say they love me, they really love me.
Right. And I won't be the king of the world or anything like that. Yeah, I try to avoid all the cliches, you know. Yeah, that's fine.
Continuing our seamless transitions from one topic to another.
It's Segway Man.
Well, just speaking of modern children's literature, we have one of our Mythgar students giving a paper on Harry Potter tomorrow.
Yes. Yeah, Chris, tell us about your paper.
It's the happy topic of dystopia.
Ooh, dystopia and Harry Potter.
Yes, everybody thinks of Harry Potter as a book that turns out really well, but there's actually a lot of dark elements in there that Rowling appears, I haven't spoken with her personally, but appears to have been influenced by things such as George Orwell's 1984 and a couple other dystopian classics. She was very well read. And a lot of different ingredients went into that soup, and I think dystopia and fiction is some of it.
Yeah, yeah.
So cool. We'll talk about that.
Nice, nice.
So a happy thing for Sunday morning.
Exactly. And it's Sunday morning. Let's talk about dystopia. Excellent, excellent. Well, thanks very much for joining us for this wholly spontaneous podcast episode. It's a tradition every time I come to MythCon, I like to do a review. You know, whenever I'm here and I'm talking about being here, I've actually been live tweeting the day, most of the day. I've been like there with my phone, you know, talking about the things that I'm learning and the things that I'm hearing about. Richard, during your talk this morning in particular, I was expressing my great excitement that you solved a mystery to which I had never known the answer before, which is why the American publisher changed the title of Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone. I'm convinced. Yeah, and just to not to leave listeners in suspense, it was because of the Indiana Jones book,
yes.
Right?
Because the I'm sorry, as I was giving the talk, what had happened was I said that poor J.K. Rowling, I thought you should pronounce her name, ran into there was Catch 18, not Catch 22. Joseph Heller published Catch 22 in 1961, but he actually published the first chapter in 1955 in a magazine form before that, but it was Catch 18. At that time. Well, so, but when they were getting it ready to publish, Leon Uris published a bestseller called Nyla 18, and the marketing department said, we can't have Catch 18 and Nyla 18 on the stands at the same time, so they changed it to Catch 22.
Right.
And so it became that. So my hypothesis is that when Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, which is the correct term for what she used.
Right.
She didn't invent it herself.
Right.
That is from medieval alchemy.
I was always so puzzled by
yeah.
that. I always assumed it was just because they thought Americans were so dumb that they...
Well, which could be the real reason,
possible.
I don't know.
Yeah.
But I think what had happened is that was published in the U.S. in 1997 as a Sorcerer's Stone. But they always look around for similar titles. So it would have been 1996 or so that they were getting it ready to be published in 1997. And Indiana Jones and the Philosopher's Stone came out in 1995.
Ah,
so it was out about the time that the marketing department at Scholastic might get concerned about the similarities in title.
Right.
And
right.
My hypothesis is that's why they wanted to change it.
Yeah.
Trademark titles.
Yeah, yeah.
There was also, of course, such an unfortunate, unintended result, which is that people who are afraid of literature with magic and witches and so forth were even more put off by the title Sorcerer's Stone that contributed to the Harry Potter book burnings.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
Not that the alchemical Philosopher's Stone is much of an improvement.
And it's all essentially Harrison Ford's fault.
Yeah. As I said, it was unfortunate that was the first book. If that had been the third book, or maybe even the second, there would have been no way they would have changed one of J.K. Rowling's titles.
Right. Yeah.
Because it was just simply too much of a phenomenon.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's almost amazing to think of that now. You know, they dared to change the title of a Harry Potter novel. You know? But yeah, it is.
After her 15 rejections and then forcing her to change her name so that she didn't look too feminine. Want to sell the book to boys.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, but that was great. So anyway, I think before I distracted myself, I was in the middle of explaining, what we're doing, giving people the opportunity to to hear about what's going on at MythCon, to sort of share, you know, some of our observations and the things that we've heard and the things that we're doing with people who can't be here. And thanks everybody for agreeing to you've all taken valuable time away from refreshments downstairs. You know, some people brought refreshments with them, which is good. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks
for listening, and Godspeed.